Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 17th, 2003. Today's session is Recovery from Grief, Session 2, presented by Corinne Chilstrom, CHC 2003-02. Let's listen in.
So, what I want to do this morning is really two-pronged, and it would be, it should be for each an hour. I'm going to try to put it together the best I can, and what I want to do is to help us understand suicide in some way, at least, of what happens in the mind of someone that thinks about suicide. And the help that I have gotten mostly is from Edwin Snydman about that in his book Definition of Suicide, a 1985 edition. He was a thanatologist at the University of Southern California, and it's a wonderful book, and it was most helpful to me. There was one question that I absolutely couldn't figure out, and that was our Andrew was very verbal, very bright. I can tell you that he was adopted, as all of our children were, and he was very, very bright, and he would express a lot of things. And when they were teenagers, there was always a curfew, and I couldn't stay awake at night to worry, so we would go to bed and we would go to sleep and close our door, but they had to always knock on our door to let us know that they were home on time. And they didn't know that often we never did look at the clock. But a lot of times when he would come, there would be something on his mind and he'd need to talk, and he'd say, "Can I come in and talk?" And so we would wake up and we'd listen and listen. And he'd have a whole lot of things to say. And what I couldn't imagine why, on that night when he was so desperate and ready to take his life when he came in, that he didn't want to come in and talk to us. I just couldn't imagine it. And this was the question that just pervaded, obsessed me. And finally I found my answer to that from Snydman, amongst a lot of other things I learned from him. The other book I want to refer to today is Christopher Lucas and Henry Seiden in their book Silent Grief. And this is about what survivors of suicide go through. I'm a survivor of suicide. That's what we're meaning by survive. It's the family and the friends who live on after their loved one has died by suicide. And it is so insightful. He's a writer, and he put some things together and has a wonderful book that's helpful. And so that's what I want to refer to this morning. The other thing is the book I mentioned yesterday or the day before, the book that I wrote, Andrew, You Died Too Soon. The title is there, Augsburg Fortress Number is there, that you could call directly for it. And this book is about the grief journey and the issues that I talked about 2 days ago. And it is also about suicide and the things that we will talk about today, plus a lot more. And then also the whole issue of adoption. As an adoptive parent and going through lots of roller coaster rides with our children, and the three of them, each with their different issues, I have written about adoption too. And so that's how it's recorded in the Library of Congress, that grief, recovery, suicide, and adoption is how it's built. So that's where you can get this book. So what I want to start out with then is to talk first of all simply about suicide. And to say a few things about it, first of all, why would I be talking about these things? Why would I, as a mother whose child has died by suicide, be so bold as to go out and give lectures about suicide? Well, people have asked me, is it therapeutic? And I would say to you, no, it is not therapeutic. It is very hard because it always brings it back fresh. But my concerns about suicide are many, and it is something that hasn't been talked about enough. I want people to understand so that maybe we can prevent it. And the other thing is to help survivors, those of us who have experienced it in our families, because we have particular needs that aren't being met because most people don't understand what our needs are. And so I want to help the community. And I have been called to communities at different places. In Wisconsin, one day I went there, there had been three teenage suicides, and the whole gymnasium was full of people, families. And so I talked about these things. One of the primary needs to talk about is the stigma we have about suicide, and that is the next overhead that I have. But first of all, I want to say that worldwide there are 1,000 suicides every day, and we're told that there are 10 attempts at suicide for every 1,000. You've mentioned a whole lot of them already from one person. In America, every 90 minutes, someone between the age of 15 and 24 is dying by suicide. It's the third leading cause of death of young people. The highest risk of suicide is early teens, 12 to 13, and later teens, 17 to 19. Boys are 4 to 5 times more often successful because they use something more lethal. Whites are 2 times more often than colored people to do suicide, and it's much higher in the West and in Alaska. We were in Alaska this spring, and we saw some results of that fact. Now, I want to get right into the stigma about suicide. When my father was 85 at the time Andrew died, and my sister and her husband brought him to us, and the first thing that my father said to me was, "Do you think God will forgive him?" Now, where does this stigma come from? And then the other thing I want to say was, on that Sunday morning that Andrew had died by suicide in our basement family room, and I was finishing dressing, and Herb had gone downstairs ahead of me. He had this wood that he had brought home in the borrowed van. We were going to unload it, and then we were going to go to church with Andrew. We were going to go out for brunch. His ride was coming at 3 o'clock to bring him back down to college. That was our plan. So we were getting dressed in grubby clothes to empty that wood, and he had gone down first. Andrew had come home for the weekend. He had gone out with friends that night and had come in at 1 o'clock. He was in, his friends said, and in good shape, they said. And Herb had gone downstairs, and he was so amazed because when he went by Andrew's bedroom, the door was open and there was nobody in the bed. And that was startling to him. But he went on downstairs. The lights were all on. The television was on in the family room. And then he went on down to the basement family room. No, he hadn't gone downstairs. He had only been down on the first floor. But then he went by the phone where we always left messages for each other. And there was a note, and that's what he came up to me with. And he said, "This almost looks like a suicide note." And I took it in my hand, and I was amazed and scared, and I ran down the steps behind her, and all the way then down to the basement family room. And we got to the landing at the bottom of the steps, and then there were 2 more steps, and the wall was there. And Herb pushed his hand against me and wouldn't let me come any further, and he saw what I wasn't able to see, and he said, "Oh God." And all I could see was Andrew's shoes, his legs, and I knew by Herb's reaction that Andrew was dead. We hadn't heard the gun go off, and we lived on a busy street in the suburb of Edina, Minneapolis, and there were always loud noises, and we got so used to it, sirens and everything, and you just didn't hear noises. You just didn't hear them.
And so we had not heard his gun go off, and he had used the gun that he used for hunting pheasants, and he died with his gun safety certificate in his billfold in his pocket. So we managed somehow to get back up the steps, but what I remember was that my knees, my legs just, I can just remember like there was nothing between me and my feet getting up the stairs, and we were holding each other to get up there, and we landed on the couch in the den and just sank into the den. But you know what the very first thought we had, Herb was a bishop at the time of Minnesota, the whole state of Minnesota, and the very first thought we had was, can we hide it? And within a few seconds, we said no. Not a grief like this, we could not possibly keep it inside. We'll have to be open and honest. And so we sat on the couch, just completely shattered, fallen apart. And suddenly I felt this rush of adrenaline, and I said, Herb, we have to have help. We have to call someone. And Herb said, we have to call the police. And so we ran over to the phone together, and he called the police, and then we called two sisters and three friends. And they were all at the phone, ready to answer on the first ring, and were there in minutes. I'll tell you more about that morning, but I want to first talk about stigma. And that was one of the things that I wondered about. Now, where did this come from? Why were we, like so many people, tempted immediately to say, how can we hide this? And many do. And there are many suicides, I'm sure, that are somehow made into accidents, and no one probably ever knows. Shortly after Andrew's death, you know, like 6 months or something, it was the next summer, I was invited to speak to a youth convention down at Purdue University. Somebody this morning said, I heard you speak there. There were 6,000 kids there. And I told Andrew's story, and I pleaded with them if they ever think about suicide for help and to live again. And but afterwards, there was a social worker that had come with a bunch of kids, and he came up to me and thanked me for my presentation. And then he said that he sees kids who are thinking about suicide sometimes, and he said they're always from troubled families. And I stepped up to him and I said, don't say that to me. And he disappeared in the crowd, and he never appeared close to me again at that conference. But this is the thought. I mean, it's a bad family. And so there's something wrong there, and that's why it happens. It's a bad family. So I did my own research until I found out some important things. Where did this stigma come from? And it's interesting to look way back in the early church during the time of persecution and mass suicides so that people would not be persecuted. It's easier to die than to be persecuted. I mean, they were even thrown to wild animals. And, you know, the Apostle Paul one place says in Philippians that to live is Christ, but to die is gain. Okay, he writes back in that period of time when to die might be better. And then Ignatius in the second century, one of the church fathers, and at that time, these church fathers' words were, we didn't have our scripture canonized yet, and so the writings of the church fathers and what was going to become scripture was all kind of like on an equal level. And he once said that, I die for Christ of my own choice unless you hinder me. Let me be given to the wild beasts, and then I can attain to God. So there was a desire to die and not to live through this persecution time. Then in the 4th century, or 5th, somewhere along there, Augustine, another famous church father, spoke out very forcefully against... can you see around me?
I can.
Move your chair a little.
Oh.
Or you move. prohibited suicide, and then about that time, the theology was that every sin has to be confessed before death in order to be saved. And so then it came about that baptism was done on the deathbed, not early in life, but on the deathbed. And then, you see, there wouldn't be any sinning afterward. And so Constantine the Great was baptized on his deathbed. In the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas, a big name in the Roman Catholic Church, he wrote the Summa Theologica, volumes of theology. And what he said was most influential then, and still into our centuries in the West here, made suicide to be a mortal sin. Like, you can't forgive a mortal sin. There were venial and mortal sins. And as a result of that, civil laws developed out of this. And so some of the laws came, if it were a suicide, then there would be no church burial. And you have heard, I'm sure, of instances where, and I know in the cemetery down where I came from in South Dakota, I heard stories about people being buried on the outside of the fence there. But then in the Middle Ages, it happened to, out of this same civil law thing, that family properties were taken away from them. I mean, families had to be punished if somebody in their family died by suicide. And then in the 11th century, it's so fascinating to know this fact, in England, they appointed a person to go out and discover why people died. Everyone had a reason of death. And that person was called a coroner. And the main reason that they did this was so that if it were found that a person died by suicide, then all of the property of that family, the whole family, was given to the crown, government property. And crown, coroner, comes from crown. And so in England, this was happening in the 11th century. And then it wasn't until the 1930s in Germany when finally there were some theologians, particularly Bonhoeffer, Barth, and Tillich, who began to deal with this issue, and they wrote this thing, that if there is forgiveness for anything, it is certainly also for suicide. So a change began in the 1930s, but that's not very long ago. So now,
so it wasn't just the Roman Catholics for whom it was a mortal sin. I guess we didn't have many other.
We were all the
then.
Same,
yeah,
until the Reformation, okay, in the 1500s. Yeah. And but this thinking has just trickled down into all of the religious communities. And it is highly influential, and that's why the effects of this early thinking still affects us here in America. And these things, I would say, the idea is people think they are lost forever. Blame the family. It's the bad family. And I want to say that this stigma is real. I know it is real. I have experienced it. So this is something that we have to know about, those of us who have experienced this in our families. Well, that's why, you know, I was just driven to do a whole lot of research. I couldn't read anything, even the newspaper, for a long time, and I couldn't even manage to listen to news for weeks afterward. But when I finally started to live again, there were things that I just had to know. And the Snydman is one of the places where I found some real help. And he is an expert in understanding suicide because he has, as a thanatologist at the University of Southern California, which means he deals with death issues, but primarily with the idea of suicide. And he has interviewed hundreds of people who have attempted but not succeeded with suicide. So he's talked to them, heard them, listened. And then beyond and above that, he has analyzed the notes that people who have died by suicide have left. And there are 80% of people who died by suicide that have left notes. Of those that you now have mentioned, how many left suicide? Andrew did.
But Carrie left a suicide. But
you don't know.
No.
But that is what he says. 80% do leave suicide notes. Now, most people think that somebody who dies by suicide is mentally ill. Carte blanche answer. That's a primary thing that people think. And or they're chemically imbalanced in some way. Or they think also that it might be vengeance of some kind. But Snyderman says, no, wait a minute. And he says, this is very complicated. And he has these... He's listed five or six, I think he had six things, categories, he would say. First of all, there's a result of loss. Sometimes it truly is a mental illness. Sometimes it is a revenge to punish someone else. Oftentimes it is to escape embarrassment, or it could be to escape pain. Sometimes it's accidental. When somebody is dying by suicide, they are so sorry they did it and they really want to live, but they're dying. And so he would call that accidental. So you can't put things into too tight of a category because there are several reasons, and sometimes it's more than one of these on top of each other. And then he says that it's a faulty thought, a kind of a syllogism, is that one thought kind of tags onto the next one, and it leads to an obsession. But then he says that three things come together: the personality, the type of a person, and then the temporality. Something happens. There's a tough break of some kind. It's like the, you know, striking a match in a haystack. And then if at that time you have something lethal that you could do it with, that's when it will happen. Now, common characteristics is something else that I learned from Snyderman. And he talks about how a person has this unendurable psychic pain, and it goes on and on and on, and it's like, probably you won't talk to anybody about it. It's a deep, dark secret. It's too bad to talk about to anybody. And finally, this person is saying, this far, but I'm not going any farther with this. There are frustrated needs of some sort that are accumulating. And then Snyderman says this: every suicide is logical to the one who decides to do it. It's hard for us to imagine if we've never been there. But that's what he says, that it's logical. This is a logical way I'm going. And what they are wanting to do, needing to do, desperate to do, is to stop the consciousness that I'm being drawn into this pain. And so then he says that the three things that ignite the spark are an unusual constriction. And what he means by that is that, and we're going to talk about the tunneling a little bit later, but the constriction is, you know, if you and I face a problem of some sort, it's a big deal. But, you know, I could do this, or I could respond this way, or I could maybe do this to get some help, or this. In other words, we might have three or four or five options of way to go. But for a person who's now in this stage, option five is closed off, and option one is not going to work, and option four is certainly not going to work, and option two is not going to work, and option three isn't either. And so finally, what they're looking at is a constriction, and that's what Snyderman means by constriction. And they're only seeing this last awful option of suicide, but it's logical, because if I go this route, then, and I'm now obsessed with it, I can't really see any other way out, this is going to relieve this nagging pain and discomfort that is just plaguing me, and this is the way to go. That's what he calls constriction. And then something makes me exceedingly upset, and I have something that'll work, highly lethal, and there you go. Then Snyderman also helps us understand about the next stage that's going to happen. This person is feeling hopeless and helpless. There's nothing more I can do. There's no one that can help me. And it is an extreme loneliness, if you can imagine. What a terrible place to finally get to. And then he talks about the ambivalence that faces a person at this stage. And when you think of this, you know, it makes you just, oh, pain for a person who gets to this point, because they are both saying, I must, I am going to do it, but there's also a cry for help. And for our Andrew, this was very evident. He had had a high school girlfriend that he really liked, but they were going to, you know, he was off to college, and so they were going to, you know, see other people. And he had a girlfriend down at the college at Gustavus that was really after him, and Andrew told me that he wanted to get rid of her because he wanted to see other people. And he asked me, what do I do, Mom, because I don't want to hurt her. And I'm, well, mothers can't do very much about that. I said, just tell her that you want to go with someone else. And he said, well, I want to go with a lot of other girls, he said. So that was a deal. And then he had a bad argument with her, and he did go into rage sometimes, and he did just left her in a rage and said, I'm going home and I'm going to kill myself this weekend. And she got real scared and went and called his friends, and they fanned out all over St. Peter, all over the town looking for him. They couldn't find him, and finally they gave up and came back to the dorm, and here he was in the room, and he was funny and jovial and making jokes, and they thought, well, you know, he just said that. So I didn't know what they knew, and they didn't know what I knew, because at that time, it must have been when he was out, he had called home, and he said he wanted to come home for the weekend. And I said, oh, it's a great weekend. We're both off this weekend, and it's wonderful if you can come. So on Friday night, he came in the door for supper, and he had a little backpack on his shoulder, and I said, where are your dirty clothes? You know how college kids. And he said, well, there wasn't room in the car. And I said, we were only three people in the car. And he said, oh, Mom, you worry too much. He said, you know, I can always get them washed down at school. And he said, do you know that one time I left my clothes down there to be washed, and I came back a couple of days later, and they were all washed and dried and folded. And I said, oh, yeah, I can imagine that, because that happened for you for 18 years at home. That's the kind of things that were going on with us. But I'm quite sure that he knew he wasn't going to need his clothes, which is a terrible, sad thing for me to say. But anyway, that night, it didn't happen that night. Herb wasn't home, and I'm sure he didn't want to do it when I was home alone. I think he wanted us to be together. And he knew his dad would be home the next night. And so it was in the night on, like early, 1 o'clock Sunday morning, I guess. It must have been. And but before he did it, he made three phone calls. And this is exactly what was happening, we think. He must have called his college roommate, and he said, it rang and rang and rang. And finally, when I picked up the phone, somebody was hanging up. The same thing happened to his girlfriend at home. And then he also made a phone call to this girlfriend from college who was home for the weekend. And his mother answered. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, and he wanted to talk to Kari. And she said, well, Andrew, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Can't you wait until morning? And he said, yes, I guess so. That week, she had taught her nursing class a study in suicide prevention. And she felt terrible. But when she told us that, I said, well, if I'd have gotten a call like that at 2 in the morning, I would have said the same thing you did, so I can't blame you. But see, this is, you know, the cry for help. And also, I must do it. And then the constriction. And then the tunneling vision. And this is what answered my question. How could he have done? Why on that night didn't he come and want to talk? And Snydman says these words, which just, oh, they just hurt when I even read them. He said, it's not that they've forgotten loved ones. It's even worse. It's not even possible for them to bring the loved ones into their range of thought, finally at that point of constriction. And then the 80% who leave a note. And then he talks about the egression being sometimes a life pattern. It's how you deal with stress. It is you cut yourself out of opportunities. You do risk-taking. You just walk away from threatening things. It was a pattern of his. But we didn't understand it, you know, in this way. And then he says that it's sometimes the lifelong coping pattern of fright from threats. And so he says that maybe suicide could be predictable and maybe preventable. So you know a lot later. Hindsight, you know, is a lot better than foresight. So he says suicide then to that person is seen not as death, but simply as a flight from the intolerable emotion. That is how they are looking at it. So.
It sounds like it's seen as a solution.
Oh, it is a solution for them. And then, you know, the other thing that's interesting is how we learn that when a person has made the plan, then they're not upset anymore, they're at peace. Because they know that this pain is going to go away because it's the problem is solved, this is how I'm going to solve it, and they're now really at peace. And that is as we see the whole scenario from the way Andrew's friends described it, that, you know, he was jovial and peaceful, and they didn't have a clue. And of course, they felt bad then that they hadn't gotten help, but they didn't know better. And so, you know, we couldn't blame them either. And, you know, maybe we should have picked up some clues too, but we didn't have a clue. It was the last thing we thought of. But when you look back, as you said, weren't you the one that said, when you look back now, then you can start seeing, when you know all of this, then you can start seeing some clues and things maybe what you could have done. Well, this is kind of another way of saying the same thing we've talked about already. So what can you do to help? Well, I don't know. There are things you could do, and maybe you can't either. You know, there are some people that make it sound like you absolutely could prevent suicide. And yeah, maybe there are some more things you could do. And maybe you were at the end of your rope. Well, believe that a suicide threat is real. Try to have open communication about feelings. Be a good listener. Don't argue. And that's something I've learned from Snydman also, and that is that don't ever argue about, you know, to kind of say, well, don't think that way, or don't, you know. The better way is to get inside of their thinking with them. In other words, if you can think as, you know, where are you in this constriction? If we can get in there with you and then think about it together. And if you can just help them find just one option so that it would make that constriction just start opening a little more. And I had an example of that happen to me One day when we were living in Chicago, a friend called and said she was so worried about Susan. We had known Susan when she was young, but she was now in a career in Chicago and in trouble with the man she was living with. It wasn't going well at all. And the mother said, "I'm so worried about Susan. She's so depressed." And so I said, "Are you worried about suicide?" And she said, "Well, I really am." She said, "Would you call her?" So I said, "Well, yes, I'll call her." You know, people think you should never mention suicide to someone because it might drive them to it. But Snyderman says, no, don't think that way, because that may be just what you need to do. In this case, it was. I called Susan, and I told her her mother had called and was worried about her and that she was depressed, she had said. And I said, "What's going on with you?" And so she began to tell me about this thing that was going on with this man she was living with and how it wasn't going well. And she just really was depressed. And I just kind of kept her talking. And then finally I asked the question. I said, "Susan, are you thinking about suicide?" And there was this long silence. And then she said, "Yes, I am." And I'm remembering now what I've learned. And so I'm thinking, well, say it right. So I said, "Well, I can imagine it could be possible." I said, "Have you thought about ways you might do it?" She said, "Yes." I said, "Well, what is it?" Well, she had her pills lined up. And so we talked about how that, you know, it's possible. You can go ahead and do that. And we just talked a little bit about that. I just let her talk. And then gradually, I tried to do what I had learned, to think about herself being in this tunnel. And how could we get one of those walls to just move a little bit? And so I said, "Well, you know, I'm just wondering if we could just talk about any other things you might think about that has helped before when you feel depressed, or any, you know, well, talking has helped, and who around here would there be that you could talk to?" And I said, "You know, you're living real close to Resurrection Church, and I know the pastor who's there," and I said, "He would be just perfect for you to talk to." And I said, Would you think about talking to him and just see if you can start to talk it out and work out some options?" And she said, "Well, you know, I would." So I said, "Well, will you stay right where you are by the phone, and I'm going to get in touch with him if I can, and if I can't, I'm going to call you right back." So she promised me she'd do that. So I called him. He answered on the first ring. "Thank you, Jesus." I told him about Susan, and he was available, and he would be glad to. And that was the beginning of a wonderful opening for her. And I saw her recently, and she is just bursting with life and talent and ability, and she's so glad to be alive. And I think about, oh, how close she might have come. And so, I mean, that's a success story, which is good to have happen sometimes. But anyway, the point is, don't argue. So get in there with them. Agree that, you know, they could, but maybe some options and what's helped before. And don't leave them alone, and get help. And that's a time that we always especially tell young people, this is not a time to keep confidences. So time is going fast, but I do want to now talk about survivors. And that's those of us who have had somebody die by suicide. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Lucas, who wrote this book together with a friend, Henry Seiden, who was a physician. The title of their book, interestingly, is called Silent Grief. And in the front of the book, they have these words from Havergal: "Silence is no certain token that no secret grief is there. Sorrow, which is never spoken, is the heaviest load to bear." And, you know, I oftentimes think, you know, in a given congregation, you know, we all look pretty well and we wear smiles. But nobody knows what pains might lie very close to that smile, because we need to know from these words and from experience that silence is not telling us for sure that there's not a secret grief right under that smile. Well, Lucas has an interesting story. And what was the energy behind what made him write? First of all, I will just tell you a little bit about what he says about suicide. Well, first of all, the definition of the survivor then is those who are victimized, he says, by suicide. It does something to us. It's like we're victims, in a sense, when someone close to us dies. And he says that there are 7 to 10 people on the average who really mourn the death of a person by suicide. So if there are 10,000, well, however it works out, with all the 30,000 suicides a year, he says in the U.S. Health Department report, then double that because lots are tabbed as accidents. Then he said we would have between 200,000 and 600,000 new survivors of suicide every year, and you too would be among them. Plus, how many others for this one suicide, and how many others for that one suicide? And so just think of all the people that we meet who are, and they probably don't give you a clue that they're one of them. He tells about there's a normal grief, a sadness and a shock and a denial, but a survivor grief suffers more guilt, more anger, more pain, and for many years. And these are some of the things that might come to us: insomnia, anxiety, exhaustion, migraines, colitis, heart disease, crying spells, fear of being alone, alcoholism, ulcers, depression, difficulty in sustaining relationships, and therefore titled, We Are a Survivor Victim. Lucas, I was going to tell you about this person who was only 6 years old when his mother died by suicide. He and his 8-year-old brother were shuttled off. They lived in England, and they were shuttled off to a relative immediately and told that their mother was ill. And then later, still at that relative's house some distance away, they were told that she died. There was no funeral, not even a memorial service that those children ever knew about. And then at age 16, this Lucas was with his father, and his father took him to the train. He was boarding the train, and the train was about to leave. He was ready to step onto the train when his father said, by the way, it was suicide that your mother died from. He's on the train, and he's down the track. And they never discussed it. Now, remember, stigma is the reason for all of this. Then when he was in his 40s, an aunt died by suicide. When he was 50, his best childhood friend died. Christopher Lucas was a writer, and he went to the literature for help. And he looked in books, articles, professional journals, all on suicide, and these were all written after 1965. He found about 2,200 pieces, articles, but he said there was only a handful that even mentioned the effect on survivors. So he interviewed a lot of people, and these were the different words that people told him, their feelings. Someone I love chose to leave me. I feel rejected because they renounced my help, and I feel worthless. And he found that many, especially men, had never discussed suicide, even with their family members. And at the time that our Andrew died, there was a woman that my husband had worked with. She was in her 60s, and she told us, but we had never known it before, out in New Jersey. She was 22, and when she came home from her job that day, she found her mother hanging dead in the basement. And she told us that she and her only brother and her father buried the mother, and they never, in all of those years, ever talked about the mother and her death. They never talked about it. So the silence is what we're talking about. But by not talking, we're not able to go through a normal grief process. And so the survivor victim has a special pain due to the silence in grief. And Lucas says it's a silence aided and abetted by the reluctance of our society to discuss suicide at all. And as I told you, that was our first response that morning when Andrew died. It only lasted a few seconds, but that was our first thought. And I have met many people through the years since who've told me those same stories. I remember being with Herb. He was bishop, and one Sunday I rode with him way up. He was preaching at church in northern Minnesota, and I remember out in the narthex. It was a rural church, and it was not small narthex, and there was a woman that was almost backing me into a corner, and I knew what she was going to tell me. And that was her story, that when she was young, her father had died by suicide, and they had never talked about it. But she saw me as somebody that she dared to talk to. And actually, that's why I go out and speak and why I write. And I have helped literally hundreds of people tell their stories, and I know that that is a way to start healing to happen. Now, this is one of the things that we learn about the post-traumatic stress disorder. Let's see, maybe I'm ahead of myself here. There are different pieces that I want to talk. One about is the issue of the place where a person died by suicide is a fearful place. And it was for us at first, for some hours at least. There were so many hot dishes that came to our house that day, and our kitchen helpers were receiving things. And so that next day, I decided, well, some of them ought to go in the freezer down in the basement. And it was down the steps, right past where Andrew had died, and into that back room. So I'm coming down the steps with this hot dish, and I froze right there. So I set the hot dish down on the landing, and I just collapsed right there on the floor where Andrew had died. And I don't know if it felt scary or, I don't know, all I could do was sit there and cry. I just sobbed my heart out, and then I found myself rubbing the carpet where I knew his blood had been. Our two sisters, bless them, they had cleaned it up. And then they took those towels home and washed them, and they put them back, and we never knew which towels they had used. I mean, things like that people did for us. But I sat there rubbing that carpet, and it was like almost the last place I could sort of connect to him. And then it turned into prayer. And what I described yesterday about going to the cross is how I envision it. Jesus at the cross saying, come and bring what you can't bear, this enormous sadness, you know, will you carry it for me? And the fear of this place, I feel afraid of this place. It's almost like it's demonic or something that made this happen. So I just stayed there, and I prayed and prayed until I was all emptied. And it was as though Jesus had taken it all. And the power of the cross is beyond anything I can describe, of emptying and taking sin, sorrow, fear, whatever, and Jesus carrying it for us. And finally, I just settled down into such a feeling of peace in that place. So that after that, it was a place I wanted to go and just be at peace again in the presence of Jesus. A place that was cleansed, forgiven,
and at peace.
And so our daughter said, Mom, you're not going to stay in this house, are you? And I said, oh, yes. I said, there's no place I'd rather be. But then what about neighbors? And a couple of weeks later, we started thinking about that. What's it like for them to be next to the house where there was suicide? And so we decided we better have them all in. So on a Sunday morning, on a Saturday morning, they were all invited, and our living room was full of people, and we just told them our whole story. And, you know, and they talked, and they got out all their feelings. And so then it was kind of peaceful, I think, for them. And then their friends, Andrew's friends. It happened, his death was on November 11th, and so we decided, well, on Thanksgiving, his friends will be home from college, so we better have a party. So we told some of his closest friends to just tell kids at church and from school, and his football friends and his wrestling friends, all to, so they knew. And so, now they had had parties there before that we didn't know about. And that night we found out about a lot of things. We found out that all that masking tape we had bought when we were going to paint the house, where had it gone? Oh, he made a grid. His older brother said, Mom will always know if you've had anybody in the house, no matter how you clean it up. And they must never go in the living room because the carpet is light. And once he had to rent a carpet cleaner for the living room, and Mom always knows. So Andrew had taken, they told us, that thick masking tape, and he had made a grid over that from the stairway into the living room, and nobody was to go in. That's what, anyway, that night we found out, and there were, I don't know, 40, 50 kids that came. We said, come between 7 and 11, and we had pizzas, and we had pop for everyone. And kids told stories. We laughed and we cried together. We had emptied out Andrew's room and all of the mementos and stuff he had from ski trips and pins and jokes and things. We had put in a big box down in the landing going to the upstairs, and we told his girlfriend and his closest friends that you have first pick and the rest can have what they want. And when they left at 11, that box was empty. And it was a real emptying out of grief for everybody. It was good for us to have his friends there, but it was also really sad because he should have been there too. And they told about how when they did have these parties, one time we had the youth worker from church to stay for the weekend, but Andrew had convinced him he didn't need to be there just that one night. And the house was full of a party, and the kid said, tonight we could park in front of your house, but when we came to the parties, we always had to park in many places around the block so that nobody would tell you. So anyway, so that's the way it went. Well, I want to say something about post-traumatic stress disorder. Oh no, I want to say one more thing about the place. Last summer, in the place where we live now, there was a suicide by hanging in the garage. And we went to the family afterwards. And the dad was just so broken up, and he said, I'll never go in that garage again, and we've got to sell our house. And we tried to help them talk it out. The mother grieved very well, but the father refused to grieve very well, and he never did go in that garage. They've sold the house. Well, I don't think they've sold it. It isn't selling, but they are building a new house, and they're ready to move into this other house. And you know, you can't run away from a thing like that, because the garage may be gone, but the memory, and you've got to get a cleansing from it. And a thing else I should say about stigma, at first I really did feel that I had, it was almost like like you brand cattle. I almost felt like I had some shining red brand on my forehead, that this is a mother of somebody who died by suicide. I felt that way. Yes. And finally, you know, I did this thing going to the cross until I was at peace with it. And it felt like it was gone. I don't know if it's gone. I oftentimes ask people, is there a brand? Do you see one? you see that? And if it is still there, yeah, it's time to go. If it's still there, it doesn't matter to me anymore because I am at peace inside. And that's the only way to take it. I just want to say a little bit about the post-traumatic stress disorder. Just like you know, the veterans from Vietnam tell, sometimes it comes back as though it's just happened. And if we don't, you know, keep the cleansing at the cross happening, we're in trouble. And all of its effects. Well, I don't know. There's so much one could say. I think finally just to say that the goal of grief, of course, is to help the head know what the heart knows. And I would say the other goal is to keep empty. And then let Christ give you resurrection. And those, I guess, are the bottom lines that I would say. I hope that we can, you know, share at 5 o'clock and from some of the things we've talked about to bring this up now, so this we need to go to church. But we're not left helpless. There's help from heaven. It's free. And Jesus is here waiting to give it to us. So let's talk at 5 here in this room.
Okay, thank you.